Okay, so the title of the program was something like Towards Materials Design. Using strongly correlated electron systems. And I sort of then change a little bit the title, because what does it mean towards material design? It means that really we need to understand understanding the strongly correlated electron systems. And then I just decided to ask the question, where do we stand? But we are taking a very specific perspective. If we want to design materials, we need to link structure and property. So we cannot really use empirical information. So we are theorists, so we would like to understand that, starting from first principles. And the outline of my talk will be the following. First, I have to tell you a little bit what the problem is. Because if I don't describe the problem to this community, it might look to you strange that we, after 20 or 30 years of working on it, we decided to take somewhat reductionistic point of view and try to understand the problem from the constituents, try to understand why copper is different than iron by starting from the atomic structure of those materials. So I'll talk a little bit about that. Then, after you familiarize yourself a little bit with what we're trying to solve, I'll tell you a little bit how we are planning to solve it. So I'll have to tell you a little bit about the toolbox that we have now to approach the problem of strongly correlated electron systems. And I like to be concrete. So originally, in my original title, I had just put the puzzle of some strongly correlated material, but Marty didn't like it, but I will just put it here in the outline. I will give a concrete example because it's hard. Sorry, Marty, but I'm going to put my concrete example, which is uranium, ruthenium 2, silicon 2, which is a specific heavy fermion that we'll tell you about. And it's not just, and I think it's an example which is suitable to illustrate the general problem of strongly correlated electron materials, because it's a material that has existed for now more than 25 years. It has a phase transition to a phase which is called the hidden order phase, because the experimentalists have not been able to determine what the ordering is, in spite of using all the possible spectroscopic tools at their disposal. So it's a good subject in which to probe our methods. Also, it exhibits all the interesting phenomena that one associates with strongly correlated electrons, such as emergence of quasiparticles, existence of novel forms of order, etc., etc., etc. So I thought that to see, to understand the problem and to see how the toolbox works, what could be better than just to tackle something that has been approached with almost every possible experimental and theoretical technique. And then I'd like to end with some discussion in which I hope that everybody will participate to answer the question, really, where do we stand, right? That was the style. Where do we stand? Okay, so that's the outline. Feel free to interrupt at any point. So, how can I introduce what are strongly correlated electrons to people who are not working and thinking about them day and night? Well, typically, they're materials, they're solids that you make with atoms with open shells. Solids that you make with, say, D or F open shells. So you just put these things together, you typically get strongly correlated solids. As an example, a famous one are the so-called high TCs. Those are things that you do by putting together copper oxide layers and some spacer layers, right? And the interesting thing is that they have remarkably high transition temperatures, was completely unexpected, and still people are arguing what's sort of the origin of this TC. Another interesting class of correlated electron systems are things which are called heavy fermions. And again, just like the ingredients are always putting together solids with open shells, open atomic shells, if you want to make a heavy fermion, you will take something with an open F shell, something like cerium or uranium or plutonium, in contact with some broad band of SPD electrons. A broad band. So then you will get low temperatures. You start always with the atomic constituents, in this case the electronic shells, and then at low energies you form very, very heavy composites of electrons, so the quasiparticles emerge from those degrees of freedom, and they have remarkably large masses. That's what are called heavy fermions. The masses can be as large as 1,000 times the mass of the electron, and then they become superconducting, insulating, or in the case of uranium, plutonium, two, silicon, two, the order in some way that people are still figuring out what it is. And these things have attracted a lot of attention because they always do something big. I mean, and the big things that they do can be either superconducting transition temperatures or can be the response functions. Probably another class of materials have the so-called colossal magnetoresistance, or the heavy masses of the heavy fermions. The big thing is the mass. Or sometimes they have metal to insulator transitions. In this case, the response is the large thing, is the resistivity changes by application of a small magnetic field. Or they change the volume. They have things which are called volume collapses of 30%, for example. So they always do remarkable phenomena, and they're always discovered by serendipity. Those are things that people just stumble across, usually solid-state chemists. And the last example is the famous case of the iron arsenide layers. People are always looking for something, but they find something else. In the case of the iron arsenides, people were trying to find better transparent conductors, and they discovered that these things are actually high-temperature superconductors.
Theoreticians must be trying to predict some cool, amazing phenomenon.
Well, so that's the question. That's the subject of the talk. I mean, basically, what can we do in the area? And I'm starting to describe first the problem. So the challenge is to, yes, at least to hit something. Yes, you got it. All right. No, volume of the material. Normally, if you look at something at this and you heat it up, it changes by a few percent when you go from 0 to 1,000 degrees. You take plutonium and you heat it up, changes the volume by 30%. You can see with your own eyes. So the properties, from the point of view of applications, one could dream that one could do lots of things if we would understand a little bit better how these materials function. And so the volume collapse of discovering cerium is with a change of the order 10-15% when you go from two phases. In plutonium is even bigger. And so in principle, we know the Hamiltonian here. So in solid state physics, we have the fortune or the misfortune of knowing what we are trying to solve, and we have the kinetic energy, the electron-electron interactions, and then we have the crystal potential, which is the thing that makes, is a part of the problem that makes it specific, that differentiates one solid from the next. And we understand a lot about the weakly correlated materials. And weakly correlated materials are really the ones for which the standard, I mean, there we have also a standard model in solid state physics. And the standard model is based on essentially Fermi liquid theory and density functional theory. So what the standard model says is that you start with this, but at sufficiently low energies, you can forget about the Coulomb interactions. This renormalizes away. And what you are left is with the Hamiltonian, which is approximately a single particle Hamiltonian, which describes electrons in a crystal, and therefore should be described by Band theory. And then, so that's called, this is sort of Fermi liquid theory in a nutshell. And then comes density functional theory in the Consham formulation, which gives you a prescription for computing the energy of the solid, and as a byproduct, a very good approximation for the band structure of the solids. So you have to solve some sort of Hartree type of equations with a potential which is called the Consham potential. And you find the eigenvalues which are labeled by a wave vector K. Those are sort of the so-called Consham bands. And it turns out that we have good methods for building this. And these Consham bands, where they're only supposed to reproduce the density of the solid, in reality, they're close enough to the band structure, to the real excitations of the material, so that if we do first order perturbation theory, in the screen-Coulomb interactions, is enough. So basically, we compute the first order diagram around the self energy around the exchange correlation potential, which was my static approximation that I used to generate by the band structure, and this is enough to explain within a few percent all the gaps of all the semiconductors, all the bandwidths of all the metals, which are not strongly correlated. So there is a framework in solid state physics that actually works. We understand what we're doing, we understand why it works, and we have predictions for computing these things. And it's sort of very annoying that this only works for weakly correlated materials. And the challenge of strongly correlated electrons is how to build a comparable construction so that we can attack all the problems in this list. And of course,
perhaps you already said it, the difference between weakly correlated and strongly correlated.
Yes, so I'm trying to come up with a definition in a case that there is not a sharp boundary. So for me, the definition is here. If you want a precise definition, here we have a very precise method for computing the properties of materials. So we just do what's called a density functional theory, which basically gives us Consham wave functions. Then we do what's called in the jargon of the community GW calculation, which is just doing first order perturbation theory in the screen-Coulomb interactions around that solution. And then we can compute all the physical properties. We can compute the bands, we can compute the gaps when you're a semiconductor. So the materials for which this works books, and there are many. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of materials and people which routinely can predict new ones using these methods. Those are the weakly correlated systems. The strongly correlated ones is where this prescription fails miserably. For example, you take something like nickel oxide, you apply this formalism, and you find that it should be a metal. It should be a metal. In reality, it's an insulator with a 2 eV gap. And then when you start thinking more deeply why this doesn't work, then you realize A, there are open F and D shells, and B, it's because this term did not renormalize away, and it's still there in the low energy physics, so you need to think of some other ways for describing them. Okay? So that's the description of sort of the problem in a very broad way. Now, I will move to the second chapter, which is the toolbox. So, how are we planning to do something about these things? So, because to have a program, it's not enough to have a problem, you need also to have something that you can do about it. So, all right, so the main tool, like David alluded to, or one of them, well, okay, there are many approaches to strong correlations, and the program is sort of relatively broad in the sense there are people which are using various ways of attacking this. What I will describe is certain angle that a fair number of the people here are taking to approach this problem, which goes under the name of DMFT, or dynamical mean field theory. But like with every important problem, it's important to look at it with every possible tool and from every perspective. So what is dynamical mean field theory? As the name indicates, it's just a mean field theory. So the idea is that we're going to start with atoms in a solid, and we're going to replace the problem of the atom in the solid by a one-side problem, which will describe an atom in a medium. So we're going to replace all the other sides by a reservoir of electrons with which the atom can exchange its own electrons. So if you like to be a little bit more concrete, so this is the DMFT mapping. If you like pictures, to be a little bit more concrete, let's just imagine that we have a Hamiltonian on the lattice, and we have some atomic Hamiltonian, which describes all the many-body theory of the atom. So this is very non-Gaussian. It has all the Coulomb interactions of the atom. And here, we put some hopping between the atoms. Then this cartoon, this site of the atom in a medium is described by what's called the Anderson impurity model. So let me write the action for the impurity model. It's going to be the action of the atom. And then here we have a bath of electrons, which is the mean field for this problem, which allows the electrons to hop back and forth between the site and the atom. So we are replacing this atomic division field by non-interacting electrons, so the action has a simple form. And this is called the hybridization function, which physically just says how effectively an electron can move from here to the other side. So if this term was zero, we would have atoms in isolation. If this term is large, it's trying to tell us that the electron can get very, very delocalized. So this is called an Anderson impurity model. An impurity model describes an atom in a medium. I still need to determine this medium in some way. And the way that we do that is we take this impurity model. So look at the impurity model as a black box which receives the atomic information and the ability of the electron to move. And from here we can extract all sorts of local quantities. We can construct, for example, the spectra of the atom with the Green's function. We can construct the self-energy of the atom with the Green's function. And we can use this, if we make a very strong assumption of locality, we can assume this here to reconstruct lattice quantities. Because given this Hamiltonian, the Green's function is going to be something like omega minus mu plus the Fourier transform of this hopping minus the self-energy of the impurity. Okay, at this point, I need to close my mean field equations. I will have to require that this bath is identical to the atom itself. So this is the lattice self-energy. This is what people measure in angle resolved for the mission. And the self-consistency condition is closed by requiring that if I sum over all wave vectors, if I look at the local quantity, this is a functional of delta, gives me the impurity model. So that's the construction, and it gives two things. First, it's fairly general, so even at this point you can see that we can start incorporating solid-state physics in it, because the atoms are the constituents of the mean field theory, and therefore different atoms will make different types of solids. You can also see that the structure of the material is very important. The structure is encoded here in the Fourier transform of this matrix, because it's this T which tells us what is geometric array of the atoms. So what this construction does, it really separates in a clean fashion the two essential ingredients that you need in order to do the design, because you are separating the atomic physics, which is here in the impurity model, in this concept of dressed atom, and the structure, which is in these hoppings, which enter the self-consistency condition. So that's sort of step number one. Step number two is that it's based on a very strong assumption of locality, in the sense that we are somehow taking the view that most of the problem in strongly correlated electrons comes in at the local level. So this self-energy, which in general is a function of K and omega, has been taken just to be a function of omega. Yes?
You're calling this an impurity model? I mean, is that because I should think about impurities in some, you know, otherwise?
This is historical reasons. Here you have a correlated atom embedded in some generalized medium. Normally, impurity models realized that idea, and this problem was investigated to a great deal in the context of impurities in metals. Now we're using that knowledge to build a mean field theory for the solid by restoring at this step the translation invariant of the solid.
What is it that you adjust to make sure that this consistency condition is solved?
Delta, the Weiss field. Delta is a function. It tells us, delta is just a magnetic field. This is no different than the Ising model. If you have an Ising model, you replace it by HS0 at one side. Okay? Then you compute every possible local quantity from this. You compute the magnetization, which depends on H. And then you fix H by a self-consistency condition that says that H was really produced by all the other atoms. Here I do exactly the same thing. I just start from an array of atoms. I focus on one. I say my local physics is the atom in the impurity. And then I determine the environment of the impurity so as to obey some self-consistency condition. In the process, I have to compute all the local quantities. Yes?
Two questions. One, is there a systematic way of improving this?
Yes. Well, okay. I will talk about how this is sort of very old, and in fact that was done in 1992 by Antoine George and myself. So this construction is very old. The reason why we're having a program is because through various studies it became quite evident in the last few years that this is actually a very good approximation, in the sense that formally this would be justified by taking a limit of infinite dimensionality. But what we can do now is we can, instead of taking one site, we can take two sites as a reference system, or four sites, and we can ask the question, are the answers changing or not? So from the point of view of cluster studies, it becomes clear that this approximation in various regimes of parameters or models like this is actually a good approximation. So that's basically how now you can tell theoretically if this, when this approach is reasonable or not. Yeah.
You also do one of the D expansions?
Well, I mean, what happens is that, and that will take me very far afield, is that the 1 over D expansions have horrible singularities, and therefore the cluster approach is a lot more promising. But what I want to say today is that for a large portion of the strongly correlated systems, for the landscape of problem that we want to study, in particular for the uranium, ruthenium, two silicon, two, I believe that a single site approximation is already enough. And in many cases, we have the ability to test when this is working or not by just doing a little bit bigger clusters and see that in certain regime of parameters, in a temperature range that we're interested, the answers are not changing very much. There was another question.
Yeah, here. Have you tried to use this for molecules?
Well, we
have exact results and you can really test.
Well, in principle, you could. In principle, this would be useful if you have some molecule where you have a very correlated site and many weakly interacting atoms. And in principle, there will be a talk at a conference, I think, by a guy from Cornell who's thinking along those lines. I mean, for me, the strong correlation problem in the solids is sufficiently difficult that, and as you see, the implementation of these things is hard enough that I think that if we can make any progress there, I'll be happy. But in terms of checking the validity, the reason why there's a lot more confidence now is because of several reasons. First of all, the cluster studies and comparison with one dimension. I mean, I think the assumption of locality should first be checked in the context of models, because this is all clear. Because if you try to formulate that directly in the continuum where you have a molecule, you will not know if the reason why your things are not working is because you took the wrong basis set. There are many other more moving parts when you go to more complicated problems. In cluster studies, there was work by Marcello Civelli and Massimo Capone, which should have been here in this workshop, but for some reasons they couldn't come. And they really benchmark in the context of a simple model, the Haber model in one dimension, and they checked that two sites there is already quite close to the exact Betti-Ansatz solution. And there, the only approximation they are making is not the model, because the model is given, but the local approximation. In this case, it was a two-site approximation that was quite good.
So why do you think that this will solve the problem for DNF or the
I'll explain that as I move a little bit further. Okay, so at this point, this had to be pedagogical, so I'm trying to distill the various ingredients. So the first ingredient is how to deal with models of this type, because this resembles already a caricature of a model of an F or this solid. If we cannot do anything about this, we may as well stop the lecture and go and do something else. So that's why I started describing things at the level of model. And there are indications that this works, at least for models, from various sources. One is the cluster studies, for example, of 1D Hubbard. with 2D, with two side clusters. The other is from cold atoms. People in cold atoms are able to actually simulate directly the hover model on a trap. So again, you know that you have the right model, you can test the local approximation. And there have been very nice studies by two groups. One is the group of Antoine George in Polytechnique. I think Lorenzo Di Leo was the first author in the paper, and another one by the group of Emmanuel Broch, and I think it was Achim Roche who did the calculations with single-site DMFT. And they show that in this case, the single-site DMFT works in the same regime that the experimentalists are doing their experiments in cold atoms. So they're both doing the same model, the Haber model. And it's even interesting. The thing where it begins to fail is because the model is not accurate, not because the approximation is not accurate. At some point, those traps cease to describe the Haber model, and that's where you see discrepancies. So this is another source of sort of, if you want, inspiration.
One has to say in all fairness that cold atoms are not cold enough.
Yes.
Now.
Yes. And the last thing that, okay, so I was giving reasons why this works. And, okay, and there are also now numerical studies of the Haber model with some algorithms that allow them to do large systems, and that's the work of Prokofiev, Matthias Troyer, who also benchmarked solutions of the Haber model in some temperature range where they can actually solve them very accurately and see that the single site approximation is quite good and the cluster approximation improves. So this is a good starting point, at least for the models. This is something that we definitely didn't know in 1992, but I feel fairly confident now. Okay, so that takes us so far. I mean, there's another concept which is sort of useful after you solve the mean field theory, which I will need later on, which is the concept of a valence histogram, which I forgot to say. Once you have your atom, the atom can be in various different valences, and it's fluctuating between all the possible valences. So if we want to understand what your atom is doing, we have to A, interpret this Weiss field, this delta of omega, that is, what is the environment. But another thing which is simpler is to look at the valence histogram. If we have, for example, a Haber model, it can be in four states. It can be either empty, can be up, can be down, or can be doubly occupied. And then we can plot the fraction of the time that the atom is occupying each valence. So if it's strongly correlated, then it will be mostly singly occupied, perhaps empty, but the double occupancy may be strongly suppressed. So those are the tools. That's our toolbox for dealing with models. But the question is, why do I think that we can do anything with real solids? And the connection comes next. How do we make this thing realistic? And the way that we make it so realistic is by introducing a basis set. Because if you start from this big Hamiltonian, and now we no longer neglect that, the moment that we define a tight binding basis set for the solids, we are introducing some concept of locality, and then the sort of in the big scheme of things, what's called LDA plus DMFT, what it attempts to do is attempts to build the full Green's function of the solid by following a little bit what we did there. So we are just going to start from the constituents, so we have the full Hamiltonian of the system. And here we can start, for example, from LDA to have some potential. But then here we're going to put some sigma, which is local, and will be constructed from a suitable impurity model. And there's been some prescriptions how to do that, that the sigma local is equal to the sigma that comes from the impurity model minus some subtraction, which has to do with the fact that there's already some interaction contained in the LDA. So that was some prescription on how to do LDA plus DMFT, and may look to you very ad hoc at the beginning. But there have been really recent studies. Okay, first, this has been used for many materials. And one thing that we want to, because now you really don't need to know too much about what solid you're studying, because there's no empirical information. We know how to get the constant potential of a material just starting from the atoms. If we know how to calculate the atomic parameters, then we can do the DMFT construction and build this. So as long as we can use this clean separation of structure and atomic physics, and as long as we can do compute this structure and we can compute the atomic physics, we're in business. We can now go ahead and predict what happens in solids. And in this sort of crude form, this was formulated in a paper with Anisimov and Sasha Poteryaev and a bunch of other people, and that was about, I don't know, 1996, I think. So this has been refined. For example, you may want to compute the density from the full Green's function and feed in the constant potential. You may do more refined perturbation theory in the Coulomb interactions screened and the Green's function and make directly the local approximation on that. But that's sort of refinements on the idea. You see now how we can now take a solid and using this huge simplification of the local approximation, we can start seeing if this makes sense for solids or not.
And this calculation, the Pontian potential is for the atom.
No. This is for the solid. In the naive prescription, this is where the solid state information is. And the idea was just very naive, just take the Kohn-Sham potential, the Kohn-Sham Hamiltonian of the material you're interested in, from a simple DFT calculation. You evaluate some screen Coulomb interactions, and then you solve the dynamic mean field equations, and you add. And then the refinements are try to make this charge self-consistent, and then just like the Kohn-Sham story was just a good starting point for doing perturbation theory in the screen Coulomb interactions and the Green's function, one can do the same game here and try to improve this a little bit. So it always goes back to the assumption to which extent the perturbation theory in the solids in terms of G and W is local, and to which degree, when you go to higher and higher orders in perturbation theory, the diagrams get more and more local. And there's a nice study, actually, by Nick Zein and Sergei Savrasov and Antropov and myself that show that at some level is true. Just by looking at the various graphs in this perturbation theory, for the real solid now, there's no more model. And when you're doing D electrons and F electrons, the approximations get better and better. The physics get more and more local.
But Gabi, why is LDA a good starting point for a strongly correlated system? I mean, starting with a metal and having an insulator doesn't sound a good starting point.
Yeah, this is true. And in reality, that's why you need... I would say, I don't want to look at it. That's why I want to look at this as sort of a box. It's not that I'm doing LDA and I'm doing perturbation theory on it. But somehow the LDA is good enough to give me some reasonable approximation to the structure part of the problem. So I'm breaking the problem into two parts. One is structure, and the other one is atomic physics. And now I'm not requesting from the LDA to give me the exact answer of everything, because it cannot. But I'm asking to give some reasonable approximation to those structure constants. And it seems it does. And the way to check is that when you look at the GW corrections, they're not so big. That's so the way to check, because just like before.
I mean, they're not so big for systems where LDA is working.
No, for LDA plus CMFT. In other words, the check for this would be to go back to this problem and just simply take this whole thing. I want to look at this whole thing together as the starting point where I can compute the corrections. This knows about MOT insulators. And there was one thing I wanted to say, and I think that at some level you see that, for example, you can ask when we do charge self-consistency and try to make the charge self-consistence between the full Green's function that has the interactions and the LDA density, the changes are not enormous. We can do the changes, we can see that the density doesn't change so much. After all, LDA gave the completely wrong spectra, but the density was still roughly okay. All right, but again, in this framework, those are things that now can be tested. I'm not saying that everything has been tested. On the contrary, I think this field is the very beginning. But the questions can be formulated cleanly and can be resolved. Okay, so now I just want to give...
What exactly is your local approximation?
The local approximation is that you take the self-energy, sigma ij, and you declare that sigma ij is equal to 0 when I is equal to j, but for sigma ii, you sum all graphs to infinite order in perturbation theory. So that's why it's called the local approximation, because you neglected all the non-local elements of the self-energy. Now in a solid, you need to introduce a good notion of locality, and for that, you need to rely on various tight binding sets. And we can get into technical details, which tight binding set is better, or how things actually work in practice, but the concept, you can already see once you put the thing in the lattice, because then this is perfectly well defined. Is it clear what is the local approximation?
I think so. Okay. The interactions are certainly not local.
Yes, the interactions are certainly not local, but what we are doing, exactly. So in principle, we are going to one more level of detail. When you do perturbation theory in W, which is the screen Coulomb interactions, you have V of Q 1 minus V of Q times phi of Q. And then the Green's function is omega minus k square root 2m minus sigma of omega and k. So the point is that, of course, your Green's function is non-local. Of course, your Coulomb interaction is non-local. What we are approximating locally are irreducible quantities. So somehow we are butchering the polarization, or we're butchering the self-energy, or we are constructing them in small clusters. So the idea is that if you have a self-energy and has many, many, many lines, or you have a polarization graph and it has many, many, many lines, then the more lines you add, the more local the graph becomes. And that has been checked in various cases. It's only exact in the limit of infinite dimensionality. So it's not the interaction that is independent of Q. It's the irreducible part, it's not the Green's function that is dependent on Q, it's the irreducible part on which it's a good idea to do the local approximation. Does that make more sense?
Well, I hear you.
Okay.
I don't know if it makes sense.
Okay. So now, let me give you...
Sorry, just one question. When you talked about the charge self-consistency, is it that you're feeding back to the LDA?
Yes.
So what point it goes back into LDA from the MFT?
Okay, so now you have G. From G, you can compute the density, the correlated density.
Yeah.
The correlated density can go into your Conchamp potential. Then you get a new Conchamp potential, and you can self-consist.
So, I mean, there's no effect on the other atoms which are so-called non-correlated, like in the uranium, ruthenium, silicon doesn't play any... I mean, those are not being correlated.
Those things are actually, turn out in practice, are actually important. I mean, but they're important at some technical level of detail. They're not so important for the big picture.
My question is that basic idea is that there is a low energy Hamiltonian involving only the the impurity orbitals or orbitals that can capture the Compton physics. Like if you're talking about an oxide, you don't have to worry about the where the details of the oxygen level, for example. Though the coupling between the B and D is via the oxygen.
Yes. So I think that the idea, the key idea is that there are certain atoms which are more correlated than others. So you need to treat the interactions among the Ds to all orders in perturbation theory, while the oxygens are more delocalized, and therefore those are already well treated at the LDA level. That's really the key idea. And that can be checked, because again, if you do straightforward perturbation theory in W and G, you can really see that the W for the D electrons is much bigger than for the P electrons. So you can see really what you're neglecting in this approximation. So it's a very exciting time that something that was completely ad hoc can now be checked, just like the DMFT was completely ad hoc, and now it can be checked by going beyond the method to test its accuracy.
And this is the iterative scheme. You're getting an improved density.
Yeah.
Does that give you an improved total energy if you put it?
Yeah. That, in fact, this was developed. This idea of doing the Cherchev consistency, in fact, was done by Sergei Savrasov and myself, and the motivation of that was to compute the phonon spectra of delta plutonium. The phonon spectra of delta plutonium had not been measured, and we wanted to predict it. And in order to predict it, you need to have something where you can compute total energies. So by including the Cherchev consistency, we were able to do that prediction, which was later checked experimentally. But that's taking me too far away. I just wanted, you'll understand better what we're trying to do if you let me give you one example. So in the last few minutes I have, I really want to talk about uranium, ruthenium-2, silicon-2, and why it's sort of, and why you really need, because the question is, well, do you really need all this to do strongly correlated electron systems? So let me tell you a little bit about the mystery of the hidden order. And that's basically a very simple compound, has only three elements. It's a BCC structure. I will just draw for you the uranium. So it's a tetragonal structure where you have the uraniums in the corner of the cell and also in the center. So the material is uranium, ruthenium-2, silicon-2. And it was discovered in 1985. And, you know, the resistivity curve, we measure resistivity in microohms, centimeters. So here will be like 300, 200, 100 microohm centimeters. And at high temperatures, and we like to plot things in logarithmic scale, so we have many energy scales in the problem. We have 100, we have 10, we have 1. And that, in some sense, is the story of strongly correlated electrons. New things happen at each energy scale, but there's no neat clean separation between the energy scales. So the traditional methods which rely on these things have all sorts of problems. And the resistivity starts very large as you start forming some composite quasiparticles. Then it go from an incoherent regime where the resistivity is large to a coherent regime where it's small. And then in between, around 17 Kelvin, there was a glitch in the resistivity, something very, very tiny. Then when you go to very, very low temperatures, eventually this becomes superconducting at 1 Kelvin, 1.5 Kelvin, where it's a superconducting transition temperature. So what was that glitch? Well, people go and made specific heat measurements and to try to figure out what's happened. And in specific heat, this was sort of a small effect, something subtle. Specific heat we measure in millijoule per degree Kelvin per mole. And these are large numbers, 100, 200. Copper will be roughly here. And this, again, so let's start from 100 degrees. We have 10 degrees, and we have 1 degree here. So around 17 degree Kelvin, there was a huge jump in the specific heat, a classic anomaly. And that was not subtle. It was just a very, very small thing. And then eventually this becomes superconducting. And then at high temperatures has a broad peak. So the question is, what's happening at this temperature, T naught? Okay? And until now, this is still called the hidden order temperature, because people were not able to figure out what's ordering. And when I say it's not subtle in the sense that the entropy loss is about 1/5 of log 2 per uranium. So it's a large fraction of entropy that gets lost at the transition. And okay, originally people thought it was a magnetic transition, and in fact people measured a tiny magnetic moment of the order of about 0.01 Bohr magneton, but that turns out to be a parasitic effect in the process of checking and induced by strain. And in any case, you would have never been able to explain this dramatic loss of entropy. But of course, in the process of cleaning the experiments and tracking what happened, they worked out completely the phase diagram of this material, and they found also something interesting. So this is pressure now. I'll put here gigapascal. And if you apply moderate amount of pressure, here we have 1.5 gigapascal, and here we have temperature. Then what they found is that at this is 20 and this is 15, and that was our hidden order transition temperature, which now gets continued. But what they found is that at high pressure, there is another phase, and that phase is just an order antiferromagnet, a local moment antiferromagnet of the simplest garden variety, with a moment here, a moment there, a moment there, just exactly what you expect. And these two phases are separated by a first order phase transition. So here we have the hidden order phase and the local moment antiferromagnet phase. And the thing which is what's sort of remarkable is that these two phases, except for the fact that here you see the order parameter and here you don't, were very, very similar. What do I mean by similar? Similar thermodynamics, which you can map, and similar Fermi surfaces that you can check by magnetic oscillations. And the experimentalists coined a word which I don't like because I think it's very misleading, but they call that phenomena adiabatic continuity. They feel that these two phases are adiabatically continuous to each other, which of course is a stupid term because this is it's a line of strong first order phase transitions. But for an experimentalist who cannot really see things, these two things look more or less the same. We can with theory. Okay, so this is a typical problem in strongly correlated electrons, and there are deep problems because it has many, many different issues that one needs to understand when one is approaching these things. First of all, you start with local degrees of freedom. You start with atoms. But when you go to these low temperatures, you see quasi-particles because you see magnetic oscillations. So at the end, out of this mass of uranium, ruthenium, and silicon, some quasi-particles emerge and have a nice Fermi surface. On the other hand, the local degrees of freedom don't completely go away because you see here you see them and here you don't, but they're ordering. So somehow the things are retained somehow in the low energy Hamiltonian.
What are the different characteristics?
Of these two phases?
In these two phases.
Well, the only thing that I can tell you is that in this one, you see a nice nail order parameter with a moment of around 0.6 Bohr magneton, and here, there's no order parameter. People have not been able to find one. So that's the difference. It's a big difference for some people because they wanted to find the order parameter. In fact, this was discovered. These high pressure studies were done in order to try to understand why there was a tiny moment there. For about 5 years, people kept fighting why there's a moment, a tiny moment of 0.01 Bohr magneton. Eventually, the answer turned out to be that you have an inclusion of this phase. These two phases are so close in energy that it's very easy to have an inclusion of this in here. And what you have is you have a small inclusion of 0.6 Bohr magneton is picked up when you average over the whole sample as a tiny moment. And by making better samples, you can reduce the parasitic moment. Okay, so how does the MFT work in this? Well, and I will just finish in the last 2 minutes. So, this is one of the problems in correlated electron materials that can be approached with the methods I described, and this specific case studies was studied by Christian Howlett. And what's interesting is that by having these languages of hybridization functions, Weiss fields, one can actually spot phases that you cannot spot with other order parameters. And in this specific case of the uranium, ruthenium, 2, silicon, 2, one can solve the DMFT equations for the hybridizations at low temperatures, taking the hint that we're looking for staggered solutions. So we have an A sublattice and a B sublattice, and we have a different hybridization in the A sublattice and the B sublattice. And now these are realistic things, so these are matrices, and I'm not going to bore you too much with what they look like, but tell you that there's one for the hidden order phase and one for the local moment antiferromagnet. Local moment antiferromagnet at low temperatures. So that looks already interesting because it seems that when you cool the system, there are two broken symmetry states. Now the next step is to try to identify a little bit better what do these solutions mean, and then it's useful to look at the valence histograms, and then you start with this mass, this big material, but then you find that at low energies, the configurations which seem to be mostly occupied are configurations with L equals to 5, S equals to 1, J equals to 4, and then you have essentially crystal fields which break it into two. One is something which has M equals to 4 minus M equals to minus 4. This is the ground state of the impurity, or a caricature of the ground state of the impurity, because it gets dressed by the bath. And the other one is a state which has opposite parity. So those are the atomic states which come out from the calculation. So out of the very complicated manifold of states, you can identify what are the ones which are likely to be the most important ones.
What is this last term?
Can't be two ground states.
I can't read it.
Oh, just when you M.
Yeah. What does it say in front of it?
Here, the sign, that's just a number. That's just a hybridization, that's just a number. A linear, you have a manifold of M states because you have J and M, okay? If you have two electrons in an atom, you label the states by M. I'm giving you an oversimplification of things because I'm describing the impurity, which is the atom by bath in terms of the atom. But that's enough to give you an idea. So if you have J equals to 4, you have 2 times 4 plus 1, right, possible states. And I'm telling you what are the ones which are important. And cosine phi and sine phi are some parameters which depend on the specific of the precise atom that we're studying, but they're not important for this discussion. So that tells you what the, gives you an idea of the playing field. Those are the configurations that you need to play with in your atom dressed by the medium. And then the hidden order and the hybridizations in the hidden order phase and in the local moment and the ferromagnetic phase are simply measured by the mixing of these two states. More precisely, you can define an order parameter at a specific site R by mixing these two states. This is your order parameter, psi of R, which mathematically what this is trying to tell you is that your ground state is just some linear combination of these two things. Okay, so psi is the degree of mixing between these two states, which have different symmetries, because under inversion, m equals to 4 is like x plus iy to the 4. So if you send, for example, y to minus y, you're sending m to minus m. So this state is odd under inversion. This one is even under inversion.
Are atomic states, right? Are they uranium states?
Yes, those are the uranium states. Uranium states. Mm-hmm. Why? Because the U in uranium is much larger than in silicon or in ruthenium, which are a lot more spread. And all right, so that comes out as the natural order parameter for this. And the expectation value of this condensate allows you to understand the form of the hybridization. So this, having these valence histograms, is a very useful tool. And then we can see what the order parameter is. We can see, for example, that when psi is imaginary, we have a magnetic moment. So it's a simple exercise to show that Jz is proportional to in psi. And then real psi is proportional to what's called an hexadecapole. And it's very satisfying that there's an approximate U1 symmetry, in the sense that the two phases, they differ by whether you take linear combinations of these states with a real coefficient or with an imaginary coefficient. So that it explains in a very, very natural language why these two phases are so similar to each other, because they just correspond to simply rotating inside the F shell something. Instead of rotating it with a real coefficient, you rotate it with an imaginary coefficient. It also explains why it's only possible to magnetize this thing along the Z direction. The moment only points in the direction of Jz. And finally, it allows sort of to construct some understanding and make some, in this case, not predictions, but explain a large number of experiments that are being done in this material. And there's one which I think is qualitative, but it's very, very striking, and has to do with the fact that we can actually study with neutrons how you go along this line. And the sort of the prediction or the idea is that, well, we have an almost U1 symmetry which is broken. So there should be something like a Goldstone mode. And this Goldstone mode should be the signature of the hidden order phase, in the sense that when psi 1, let's write psi equals to psi 1 plus psi 2. If psi 1 is different from 0, if you condense here, that's this phase, the hidden order phase, then the Goldstone mode is actually psi 2. And this one carries moment, carries Jz, so this can be seen by neutrons. When psi 2 is different from 0, there's also an almost Goldstone mode that will be psi 1, but this one is invisible to neutrons. So the prediction of what should be seen in neutron scattering is the there should be a low-lying mode in neutrons along the 001 direction, and only when you are inside the hidden order phase. So that's a clean prediction, and that's really seen in neutron scattering in the sense that the intensity as a function of energy has a peak around 2 milli electron volts, which is a very, very low energy scale. And I'm doing this to scale, so this is 50 counts, and this is like 100 counts. So if you measure this at 1.5 Kelvin, you see nothing. If you see at measure at 20 Kelvin, you see nothing. But if you measure it in between, in this window, then you get a peak. So that basically is the end of showing you how one goes from the microscopics to the experiment. And then I just have some general comments just to wrap this up and to sort of link the things back to material design. So I hope I convinced you of several things. First, we have something which is like a theoretical spectroscopy. I didn't do justice to this problem in the sense that I didn't show you all the detailed spectroscopic studies, for example, tunneling, STM, ARPES, that were done in linking the behavior from the high energy all the way to the low energy. So we can track how the quasiparticles emerge. So this is not the shot in the dark. Even if it turns out that this is not really the right order parameter when it's tested experimentally, one can go back, which I think it is, but even if it's not, one can go back in this loop of material design and see what part of the machinery needs improvement. That's point number one. Point number two, we have something now that can bridge between property and between structure and property. So that's zeroth order element that you need to do material design. The question is whether we have some bridge that we can that takes us from this all the way to all these experiments. And the questions that one discusses in this workshop is, well, okay, this is very new, and it's not a very robust bridge, because we're sort of at the very, very beginning of trying to build these things. But the discussion is how to improve it, how to make it more robust, how to increase the accuracy. As you see, even though there's a gem of some ideas, there's still a lot that need to be built in order to have something where we can predict properties of strongly correlated systems with the same ease that people do things in the semiconductor. So that's sort of the subject of the workshop. But at a different level, I think this is needed not just to design materials, because this is the minimal thing needed to describe strongly correlated electrons. That's sort of the nature of the problem. And the problem is that the character of the information, of the atomic information, doesn't get completely erased by the time that you get to 17 degree Kelvin. When I was working on this problem 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I was always under the impression that there is something like a renormalization group flow that will wash out all the dirty microscopic details, and what will be left with something very, very simple that we need to study. Now, what we seem to be finding through the study of many, many materials is that strongly correlated electrons contain beautiful phenomena, contain hidden order transitions, contain very highly non-trivial quasiparticles, but somehow to understand this flow and to understand how that thing happens in a case-by-case example, one really need to follow the microscopic details. Because at the end of the day, the quasiparticles of the hidden order at 17 Kelvin knows what are the uranium degrees of freedom at 1,000 degree Kelvin. And that's perhaps the reason why we're taking what you call the reductionist approach. I mean, it's not exactly a reductionist approach. It's a minimalist approach. It's a minimum that is needed to understand what one sees. And in this, with this comment, I will stop and see if there are more questions.
we're getting a bit late, so but I'm sure there are a few questions. I have a question, but no questions from participants in the program. My question is this, to an outsider, this sounds like it's totally orthogonal to those people who start with an exploration of the quantum theoretical point of view.
Yes.
And then, how much that influences on the material. So the question here is, can you reproduce a quantum critical point?
Well, I mean, do you see a quantum critical point in the phase diagram? I mean, in this specific example, nature provides you two very similar phases, actually separated by some nice first-order transition. I mean, people are talking about hidden criticality.
That wasn't the question. In this case, but, you know, might be. But could you, in a system which had a quantum critical point, could you reproduce that for the same physics?
Well, I mean, if you can ask a mathematical question. If you apply these various schemes of the MFT and try to describe critical points, you get which description do you get? And I think you get descriptions of critical points above the upper critical dimension. Because at the end of the day, it's sort of like a just up mean field theory with some one loop corrections that come for free. So you get sort of Moria's, Hertz, Miller's, certainly for free from this type of approach. But that's not the thing which I find interesting in the following sense. The place where we are stuck in strongly correlated electrons is not that we don't understand a specific quantum critical point, that we don't know if it exists or not. We're stuck because we're not able to describe all the things that we see in all these materials. We're not able to understand which ones are superconducting, which ones, and how this very rich evolution takes place. So you can either focus on something that you don't see, because ultimately all the critical points that exist in correlated electrons are always hidden by something. So you have to study something which is hidden. Or you focus on what you can actually track and have an interplay with experiment. And I think what I find appealing is that this is really a theoretical spectroscopy. It's formulated in the same language as experimentalists. So even if your shot in the dark is incorrect, you can go and fine-tune it and do better the next time. Vincent?
What about brute force numerics?
Well, okay, so now comes about the details of how we actually solve. So the problem is that brute force numerics has not yet been able to really solve the model. So in the Haber model, now people can do reliably things at relatively high temperatures. Now, to me, it seems almost hopeless that those approaches will be able to tackle all the complications of uranium, ruthenium, copper, etc. So from that perspective, now, of course, there are other attempts, and I think we should learn from them, of approaching the quantum many-body problem from other points of view. There are schools of thought which are doing many-body perturbation theory or Monte Carlo methods. And from that perspective, this is an orthogonal approach that we should see. To the extent that physics is local, this is good. To the extent that quantum Monte Carlo methods can do exact calculations of small systems, then it's a benchmark. I mean, it's not that there is a competition. I think there are very different viewpoints looking at the same problem and trying to figure out how to make better materials.
Do you think you have, I mean, this gives you the solution of the Haber model in three dimensions?
Well, I mean, in some temperature regime, just like the simulations give you the solution of the Haber model in some temperature regime, you see, the approach is based on locality. I believe that if you push things enough, eventually the assumptions of locality in some regime, it's going to break down. But yes, that's one limitation. The other limitation is that you need to guess the phases. If you want to construct a phase diagram with this method, you have to guess all the possible broken symmetries and build mean field solutions for them. Somebody who would have the exact solution of the thermodynamic limit would not have to do that. He would have all the phase diagram for free. So those are basically the two limitations. But yes, there is a broad regime of parameters where one can actually say that one has the solution. And the cold atom people proved it.
No.
With not two cold atoms.
No.
Scales of J.
Any other questions? Okay. Thanks a lot.